it's Tuck Everlasting. I was 9 years old, and my closest friend was my teacher. I lived in New York, not too far from the place Tuck is set. I remember seeing Tuck's distinctive yellow cover, with its painting by the author, around my elementary school. It was one of those books that everyone in my class had read, even though it hadn't been assigned, the increasingly battered library copy making its way from one kid to the next. Tuck Everlasting was rumored to be terribly sad, but in a pleasurable way, like Katherine Patterson's Bridge to Terabithia, Lois Lowry's A Summer to Die, or E.B. White's Charlotte's Web. The ultimate insult in the 1980s was to be called a crybaby, and yet we loved to make ourselves cry. The measure of a good children's book was how much we wept while reading it. The first time I read Tuck Everlasting, I cried a lot. It was a very good book. My child self deemed Winnie Foster, the protagonist of Tuck Everlasting, an entirely convincing 10-year-old, and my adult self agrees. When we meet Winnie, she is aggrieved by both the confinements of her life and the way she is perceived by her family. She longs for adventure, but is scared to spend the night at someone else's house. Something I admire in Babbitt's characterization is how often Winnie is depicted in solitude. She doesn't confide in a friend. She has adults who care for her, but none with whom she can share the innermost secrets of her heart. She puzzles out the mysteries of the world alone. The questions she contemplates in Tuck are enormous for a person of any age. If you could live forever, would you? What is the value of a mortal life? Is killing sometimes justified? Winnie may be 10, but Babbitt believes her to be up to the task. Reading Tuck today, 37 years after I first read it, I am struck by its lack of condescension, both in the way Winnie is depicted and in the demands Babbitt makes of her ostensibly young audience. Consider the moment in the book when Winnie observes Tuck, the father, watching another man die. She turned her eyes away quickly, looking to Tuck for relief. But Tuck was not looking back at her. Instead, he was gazing at the body on the ground, leaning forward slightly, his brows drawn down, his mouth a little open. It was as if he were entranced, and yes, envious, like a starving man looking through a window at a banquet. Winnie could not bear to see him like that. She reached out a hand and touched him, and it broke the spell. Winnie's observation that it is possible for a person to be envious of a dying man is extraordinary, but within this paragraph, we also see Winnie's transition from child to adult. She seeks comfort, but then finds herself offering it instead. Throughout the text, I appreciate the interactions between Winnie and all the members of the Tuck family. They treat her like a person capable of understanding complex things. They offer explanations, but they allow her the space to come to her own conclusions. It is a space given to the readers and listeners of Tuck 2. This kind of space can occasionally be scary for adults. In an interview in Publishers Weekly for the 40th anniversary of the book, Natalie Babbitt described a father punching a school principal because he found the book too scandalous to be taught in schools. The article doesn't say what the father found so provocative in the text. It's tempting to imagine this interaction as the relic of a less enlightened era, until you remember that we are currently living through a similarly unenlightened era. I found myself wondering what had scandalized that father so much. Although it is fewer than 200 pages, Tuck Everlasting contains a kidnapping, a prison break, a murder, a potential hanging, attempted extortion, and of course that magical spring. There is an almost marriage proposal, a mouse in a drawer, an immortal toad, and an evil land developer. But I don't believe the man was provoked by any of those things. Natalie Babbitt once said, "I wrote Tuck to help my daughter Lucy understand what life is all about, that we all get born and we all have to die. I wanted to be sure Lucy would not grow up scared." There are some adults who do want children to grow up scared, and I suspect the principal assaulting father might have been among them. On some level, isn't this the great work of the children's book author? To discuss the hardest subjects, the ones parents would rather avoid, to help a child not grow up scared. For a children's book, the most expedient path to immortality, the magical spring, if you will, is winning a prize. In an interview for the 25th anniversary of the book, Natalie Babbitt discussed Tuck Everlasting's failure to receive either the Newbery Medal or an honor. The interviewer, Betsy Hearn, speculated that the book's omission was because Tuck's themes are too morally complicated for a child reader. Babbitt said she had heard from a prize committee member that Tuck lost because of a perceived logical fallacy in the book. Babbitt's theory aligns with what I know of children's book prize committees. They sometimes seem to confuse literary ambiguity with error. A great novel,